Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret interview Dr. Michelle Gordien about her book, Reclaiming Our Health, A Guide to African American Wellness. In the Tech Report segment, Lauren Bonner speaks with the inventor of an iPhone-based ECG device. And we begin with this week's bright idea. Here's Mark Maselli.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our community and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on one Mississippi church that's on a mission to fight obesity. Mississippi has one of the highest rates of obesity in the country, and the Delta region, which is also the poorest, ranks the worst on just about every list of health indicators. Because the church is very much a part of everyone's life in the Delta, one reverend felt he had a duty to install healthier habits for his parishioners. High obesity rates are fueled in large part by the deep-fried Delta diet, a tradition passed down through the generations and sustained through cultural mainstays like the church. About 10 years ago, the Reverend Michael Miner stopped serving fried food, soft drinks, and sweet teas in his Oak Hill church. He even built a track around the building for organized walks. He wanted other churches in the area to follow, but that was going to take some work. He approached hesitant pastors with a simple, convincing argument. Sick members can't tithe. Several churches in the area have adopted Reverend Miner's message over the past few years. Most recently, the National Baptist Convention, which represents roughly 10,000 churches, will embark on an ambitious health campaign organized by Reverend Miner. It will place a health ambassador in every member church by September 2012. Spreading the message of health in a culturally appropriate way and with leadership that the community trusts. Now that's a bright idea. Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Dr. Michelle Gordien, physician, author, and health policy specialist. Dr. Gordien is CEO of the Michelle Gordien & Associates, a health policy consulting firm, and her new book is called Reclaiming Our Health, A Guide to African American Wellness. Welcome, Dr. Gordien.
Thank you for having me.
This summer, the nation celebrated the opening of the Martin Luther King Memorial in Washington, D.C. This is another great milestone since the passage of the Civil Rights legislation in 1964. In your book, you note the progress that Black men and women have made on a number of fronts, political, economic, and educational, accomplishing some of what Martin Luther King said needed to be done if America is to be a great nation. But clearly the journey is not done, and you paint a very detailed, and I might add, distressing portrait of the health of Black Americans. You suggest it's still one of the unfinished battles in the civil rights movement. Tell us why African Americans haven't experienced the same gains in health outcomes as they have in so many other areas.
Sure. That's an issue that physicians like myself and scientists have been struggling about for many, many years. African Americans are impacted by serious health conditions at far greater rates than any other group in this country. And what are we talking about here? We're talking about the fact that African Americans have the highest rates of high blood pressure in this country, that they are more likely to be overweight or obese, and obesity is what I consider to be a gateway condition that leads to heart disease and diabetes and stroke. And so when I began to learn about all of these statistics, obviously when I was in medical school and then beyond, they impacted me in a number of ways because they were not only sort of detached statistics, but they were relevant to me and to my family and to my community. And so one of the things I wanted to do in Reclaiming Our Health was to try to figure out what's behind these statistics. Why is it that African Americans are more impacted by serious disease? And then, more importantly, try to outline what we know from all the research that's been done over several decades, what we know about how we can begin to turn this problem around. Because, as you stated, I do consider this to be our last civil rights frontier. We've got an African-American in the White House. We have African-Americans leading both parties currently in mm-hmm. this current race for presidential election. And so why is it that we can't make those same strides with our health? That's what Reclaiming Our Health attempts to investigate and to evaluate.
Dr. Gradin, as an African-American physician yourself, you speak with such clarity about those core cultural issues that may have an impact on health. And you're always, throughout your book, peeling back the layers to try and get down to root causes and saying that African-Americans need to consider these, but also healthcare providers need to consider from the role of traditional soul foods, delicious but maybe not the best for hypertension or obesity or diabetes, to a reluctance to exercise and work up a sweat for very practical reasons. Okay. And as you've worked through that, what are the conclusions you've come to about how we train this generation of healthcare providers to be not just sensitive to and competent in, but very aware of and working directly with those issues as they care for their African-American patients?
You know, it turns out that not only is it important to understand the biological basis of disease, but that two of the most important factors in creating disease and or wellness are our culture and environment. And Reclaiming Our Health explores the connection between culture, environment, and health. And so when we're training future physicians, clearly they need to be knowledgeable about the biological basis of disease to understand how disease happens. But they also need to understand how culture and environment interact with biology to create illness. And so let me give you a really practical example, and you brought it up as you were speaking before. And this is one that, to be quite frank, some of my colleagues have considered to be a sort of frivolous mm-hmm. point, but it actually is very, very important because culture does influence how we act. African-American women, I am one, have a very special relationship with our hair. Many of us don't have wash and wear hairdos, and so we spend many, many hours on a Saturday afternoon and many, many dollars in a hair salon getting our hair done. You would be hard-pressed to ask those same women who spent all day Saturday and upwards of $100 in the salon getting their hair done to then go on Monday morning and work out on a treadmill, work up a sweat, and ruin mm-hmm. that hairstyle. This is not frivolous. Culture really does shape people's behaviors. It's based on people's beliefs, and it's extremely important to try to understand the cultural factors that motivate people's behaviors, because only then, once we've identified people's motivations, can we offer practical advice as physicians that's going to be followed and going to be effective for our patients in helping them on their journey to reclaiming their health. And so we explored that. The other piece of it, though, is not just culture, but it's environment. You know, I give the example all the time. I'm a pediatrician. And I used to, when I saw patients full-time, advise their parents to make sure your child eats a balanced diet, gets plenty of fruits and vegetables, drinks lots of water. And oftentimes the advice that I was giving was very hollow because many of my patients lived in neighborhoods where there were no supermarkets, there were no farmers markets. In terms of physical activity, there were no sidewalks for children to safely walk on or backyards or parks for children to safely play in. Living in an environment where you can't access the resources that you need to be healthy, those resources being fresh produce, fresh foods, accessibility to affordable physical activity, then telling a patient to eat right and to get plenty of exercise is pretty hollow advice. And so we need to look at culture and we need to look at environment as healthcare providers and ensure that we're providing the proper environments for individuals to be maximally healthy.
Dr. Gordine, pull the thread on that for us a little. You say that place matters. In fact, that where one lives, their zip code is as important as economics and ethnicity plays a role in their health. There are a lot of things one can do for their health as far as walking and eating right, which you recommend. But what does someone do if they're trapped in a neighborhood that they can't move out of? How do we start building and making healthier communities?
Well, you know, even as important as it is to take individual steps to be healthy, you know, eating right, exercising, mm-hmm. seeing the doctor on a regular basis, what's equally as important is being vocal. There's a lot of power in each of our individual voices. Participating in the policy-making process, as it were, is something that we don't typically teach people to do in terms of maintaining good health, but it's extremely important. For example, when elected officials come to your neighborhood soliciting your vote or come to your neighborhood hosting a town hall meeting, speak up.
Mm-hmm.
Demand that your neighborhood have supermarkets. Demand that your streets are safer with better police presence and better lighting. Make sure that those officials that you elect into office understand that those factors are important to you. So health is obviously not only individual actions, but it's also a little bit of advocacy. And, you know, the progress that African Americans and other groups have made in this country over decades has come because of political action and advocacy. And that same advocacy is going to be important in ensuring that all of us have the equal resources and equal opportunities to be healthy.
Well, that's a sort of segue into your three S's that you talked about in the book, the impact of stress, smoking and sleep, or
yes,
the lack thereof, on people's health. And I'd like to focus on the stress piece, which certainly ties to the other two. You note that stress is kind of an equal opportunity problem for Americans. People generally operate at a high level of stress, but there are additional and unique burdens and stressors that African-American communities and individuals have faced from both perceived racism and discrimination and also some of the economic barriers that have persisted. And we often say, I'll make the analogy to the obesity epidemic, not going to be solved in the clinician's exam room. You know, it's going to take something much broader and deeper than that. What's the conversation with your patients or with communities, with the healthcare community, about how you lower stress for an entire population of people to improve health?
Stress is something that African Americans have had to deal with and have dealt with in very unique ways based on our history. I talk about the fact that African Americans often employ stoicism mm-hmm. and silence in dealing with stress. Stoicism, putting on a front of that gives the appearance that everything is okay, not showing any emotion, and silence being a reluctance to talk about the stressors of their lives, you know, in vernacular terms, not putting our business out in the street.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that really does, I believe, stem back to slavery days when if slaves showed any type of emotion at all, despite all of the turmoil that was happening in their lives, families being torn apart from each other, wives being sold out from under husbands, children being taken away from slaves, if they showed any emotion in relation to those traumatic life events, they were beaten. And that sort of stoicism and that silence, that resistance to showing any type of emotion, holding emotion in, has passed down through generations and generations of African Americans. And there is actually research that shows now that there can be two African Americans who experience similar types of discrimination, either in the workplace or elsewhere, and that the African American who tends to employ the traditional response to stress, that is holding that emotion in, not talking about it, is much more likely to experience major health effects from holding it in, like elevated blood pressure and all of the various conditions that come along with high blood pressure. Conversely, the African-American who talks about or expresses emotion in relation to that stressor tends to have better health outcomes and less adverse health effects from experiencing that same type of stress. So it's less the stressor that we experience and more related to the way that we deal with stress that has an impact negatively on our health. And so as African Americans, we need to begin to adopt better stress coping mechanisms in order to begin to improve our health.
So, Dr. Gordine, towards the end of your book, you move from some of the root causes of poor health and the actions people can take to delving into the healthcare system, right?
Yeah.
And I was so struck that you were so inclusive of everybody, regardless of where they might fall on the insurance, uninsurance, economic stratum, and directing people to say, you know, for private insurance, use it wisely. If you don't have insurance, look for community health centers, look for some of the systems that are set up to support that. So we live in this moment when the Affordable Care Act is being implemented, mm-hmm. and we hope that no insurance will become a thing of the past. Tell us what you see the promise of the Affordable Care Act in terms of making a significant improvement in the health of African Americans as well as all Americans. What are the elements of the act that are really going to make a difference? What are your hopes?
The Affordable Care Act does place an emphasis on prevention. There are certain preventive health services that are going to be offered free to certain populations, and I think that that's very important because currently, if you look at the $2.2 trillion a year that we spend on health care, 95% of that money, or 95 cents out of every dollar that we spend on health care, is spent on treatment, and only 5 cents is spent on prevention. The ACA, in emphasizing prevention, is creating a more balanced health care system, which I think is extremely important because the main conditions that are the leading causes of death, not only for African Americans, but for all Americans, heart disease and cancer and stroke and diabetes, are largely preventable, you know, by very simple steps that we all know about: eating right, exercising, not smoking, getting checkups on a regular basis, maintaining a healthy weight. And so by emphasizing prevention in the Affordable Care Act, hopefully what we will do is begin to encourage people to take their health into their own hands. You know, if you think about it, if you are even moderately healthy, you may see the doctor 4 or 5 times a year. So who's responsible for your health the other 365 days of the year? You are. Mm-hmm. And there are very important steps that I outline in Reclaiming Our Health. That actually, to be honest with you, Reclaiming Our Health is a book that could be read and used by anyone.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
These tips are not necessarily exclusive to African Americans. They're written in regards to African American culture, but certainly they can be utilized by anybody. And by utilizing these steps, we can take better charge of our health, and the ACA helps do that by focusing on prevention and providing access to care.
I think you're absolutely right. The book could be read by anyone, but you know, there is an enormous gap between African Americans and white Americans. And I think we sort of gloss over it when we say there's ethnic and racial health disparities. You lay out sort of 4 things that African Americans should know about their health status, and they're really profound in terms of how different the outcomes are for people in terms of the length of life, the impact on chronic disease. Can you tell our listeners a little more, give them a little more texture about the depth of the disparity?
Yes. African Americans, again, I can't emphasize this enough, suffer from serious health conditions at far greater rates than any other race or ethnic group in this country. African Americans' life expectancy is about 5 years less on average than whites. African Americans have higher death rates from heart disease. African Americans actually have higher death rates from cancer than whites, which is remarkable, especially when you look at breast cancer, where white women are more likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer, but black women are more likely to die from breast cancer, and that's because the cancer is discovered in a more advanced stage. African Americans have the highest rates of high blood pressure in the world. When you look at African Americans who have diabetes, they are more likely to lose a limb to amputation than whites with diabetes. The list goes on and on. The disparities are real, and they have been persistent despite all of the medical advances that have been made in disease diagnosis and treatment over the years. African Americans have not benefited as much as whites from the advances in health care. And so that's why I felt compelled
yes.
to write this book, because we need to understand that. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that Americans in general, black and white and otherwise, are not aware of these disparities, and awareness mm-hmm. is the first step to addressing them.
Today we've been speaking with Dr. Michelle Gordine, physician, health policy expert, and author of the book Reclaiming Our Health, A Guide to African American Wellness. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
We close with the Tech Report, our weekly look at how people are using technology to improve health and wellness. I'm Lauren Bonner. Sound familiar? You've probably heard and seen this well-known ECG test, perhaps on one of the several TV medical dramas over the years. ECG tests record the electrical activity of the heart. They're useful tools for healthcare providers to find out if a patient has heart disease, heart damage, or an abnormal heart rhythm. Normally, the reading is done by attaching painless electrode patches to a patient's chest from an ECG machine. But as Dr. David Albert will tell you, in just over 100 years, we've been able to shrink what was once a very large operation to, well, a tool the size of an iPhone. Albert is founder and president of AliveCor, an inventor of the iPhone ECG.
We have a product that is this very simple. It will sell at retail for less than $100. And that probably is the most disruptive part of it.
Meaning not just large healthcare systems can afford to use it. It's for everyone. The technology is essentially a special iPhone case and an app the user downloads. Up against a person's chest, it'll record a clinical quality electrocardiograph, display a real-time heart rate, and then present the option of uploading the reading and sending it over a secure portal. Of course, it's useful in a professional healthcare practice, but it may be most appropriate for mobile healthcare workers like EMTs and home health nurses. And it's an affordable tool for mobile healthcare workers in the developing world. Then there's the consumer use. Dr. Albert says a tool like this gives patients the opportunity to engage with their health.
It could be somebody, one of the 12 million people who've survived a heart attack in the United States, or one of the 3 million people with atrial fibrillation who see those direct-to-TV ads all the time talking about them. They go and buy it themselves, and they print out their own ECGs, and they take them to their physician because they're concerned.
The iPhone ECG is not limited to clinical use. It can also be used as a personal biofeedback device where someone can learn specific therapeutic actions, like meditation or breathing techniques to lower blood pressure and reduce the stresses of everyday life. In fact, this might be useful for Dr. Albert himself. He admits the last year has been a whirlwind after uploading a YouTube video of the device before attending the Consumer Electronics Show in January. Interest in the iPhone ECG skyrocketed.
By that Sunday, by the way, I had 100,000 views on that video. Today, I have 300,000 views of that video. You know, I haven't been home three consecutive days since August 1st when we closed our venture capital round.
As one of the big hits at the Consumer Electronics Show, the device has been fast-tracked for commercial use ever since. The iPhone ECG is currently being tested in two clinical trials, which will determine if consumers can actually record useful clinical data on their own. It will likely be commercially available in Europe first and then available here in the U.S. in early 2012.
That's Lauren Bonner with this week's edition of the Tech Report. If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.